Let's find out what it says in Friday's papers now. Here's Valerie Cox.
Women now drink as much as men. That's the banner headline across the front of the Irish Examiner this morning. But read on, and it's a survey of college students by UCC PhD candidate Martin Davoren. Owen English says these findings have led yet again to calls for the government to reconsider a ban on sports alcohol sponsorship. That story also appears inside the Irish Times under two-thirds of students report hazardous drinking. And the Irish Independent says female students matching men for problem drinking. Back on the front of the Examiner, Cormac O'Keefe reports that an estimated 30 Irish citizens had travelled to fight in Syria and Iraq by the end of last month, up by 15% on last year. Shatter asked for exclusion from Dáil inquiry is the headline for the Times. Fia Kelly reporting that the former Minister for Justice, Alan Shatter, asked Ciarán Cóirle, Sean Barrett, to exclude his handling of claims made by whistleblower Sergeant Maurice McCabe from an inquiry into allegations of Garda malpractice. There's plenty of snowy pictures in all the papers. 50 Shades of White, says a very literary Irish Daily Mail. Now is the winter of our discontent, and it's here for a while. Snow Limit, says the Irish Daily Star, where Senan Hogan promises that the worst may be yet to come, and February could usher in the worst winter blizzards for half a century. Snow escape, says the Irish Daily Mirror. Ireland was last night warned to brace itself for an extreme wintry blast as snowstorms battered the country. The lead story for the Star from Patrick O'Connell says boxer Matthew Macklin has told of his terror after armed Gardaí raided an apartment he was staying in yesterday. It was like something you'd see in a film, he said. We were caught up in this completely innocently. I'm over here to take part in a charity gig. Another PPS bungle over Irish water is the lead story for the Mail, which says that PPS numbers will have to be handed over if families want to claim their €100 water conservation grant. Neil Michaels says the government was last night accused of making this up as it goes along, after it announced in November that Irish Water would delete people's PPS numbers, following a groundswell of opposition against the policy. The paper's editorial says the coalition has blundered aimlessly from one crisis to another, The coalition also makes the lead for the Independent, with Aer Lingus sale in jeopardy as coalition unease grows. It says the deal has been met with an extraordinary level of opposition from government TDs. The alarm bells finally seem to be going off for Fine Gael cabinet members, says the paper's editorial, and it concludes the national interest of the airline and the country as a whole will be better served by the government maintaining its stake in this vital piece of national infrastructure. In other stories, Donal Hickey reports in the Examiner that it looks as if visitors to one of our main tourist towns, notorious for the rain, will have to bring their own wet gear for some time to come. Plans to put a roof over Main Street Killarney in the form of large portable umbrellas have stalled since the abolition of the local town council in June. At this week's meeting of the municipal authority, Councillor Michael Gleeson asked if the eagerly awaited umbrellas had been blown off the agenda. And with strong winds and sleet falling outside the chamber, says Hickey, the meeting was told that the umbrellas could withstand gusts of up to 60 kilometres an hour, but would be closed in those conditions. Finally, the papers are still commenting on the verbal abuse aimed at President Michael D. Higgins. It represents a new low, writes Noel Whelan in the Times. Our politics is likely to be even more volatile as the election approaches. The potential for an even more abusive atmosphere is therefore greater. And a letter writer to the Times, Brian Ahern from Dublin 15, says, I hope poetry will help Michael D. Higgins to see that the worst is full of passionate intensity.
Time for business news now. Conor Brophy's here. Morning, Conor.
Morning, Gavin. It's expected quarterly figures due out this afternoon in the US will show strong growth from the world's largest economy, boosted by lower oil prices. Gross domestic product probably expanded at an annualised pace of 3%, according to a survey of economists by the newswire Reuters. That would be the fifth quarter out of the past six that the US economy has shown growth at an annual pace of 3% or higher. Contrast that with a Eurozone economy, which is struggling to maintain a pace of just over 0.5%. Over 30 billion euro worth of loans were sold by Irish banks and the National Asset Management Agency last year, and a new report by accountants PwC predicts at least a further 6 billion will be sold this year. Much of that was property-related debt, and the Irish market accounted for almost a third of the total loan sales by European banks last year. There remains around 2 trillion worth of unwanted loans on bank balance sheets, according to PwC, which says the market for loan portfolios is expected to remain buoyant for some time to come. Google has cut back investment in its Google Glass project just a month after announcing it was almost ready to progress towards full commercialization of the wearable technology. The company said the Glass headset, which enables users to access a range of internet-powered features, film what they can see, and take video calls in vision, had failed to meet internal targets. Here's Google's chief financial officer, Patrick Pichette, explaining on a conference call with investors what Google expects from projects such as Glass and what happens if they fail to perform.
In cases where we achieve success against our milestones, we expand our investments. In other cases, when the teams aren't able to hit hurdles, but we think there's still a lot of promise, we might ask them to take a pause and take the time to reset their strategy, as we recently did in the case of Glass. And in those situations where projects don't have the impact we had hoped for, we do take the tough calls. We make the decision to cancel them, and you've seen us do this time and time again.
Finally for now, in currencies, the euro trading at $1.13.3 and 75.2 pence sterling.
Revelations by RTE yesterday that the Department of Social Protection will need additional resources and budgets to administer the government's water conservation grant are likely to motivate people planning on protesting against the introduction of water charges this weekend. A round of demonstrations are planned all over the country across the weekend. Despite significant opposition, over a million households have already registered with Irish Water. Socialist TD Joe Higgins is on the line. Good morning to you, Joe.
Good morning, Frank.
Protests over the weekend, Joe, numbers-wise, how many people are likely to turn out?
Well, there will be very extensive protests, and there will be large numbers participating. However, it would be completely wrong that, as some sections of the media hostile to the anti-water charges campaign are doing, deliberately trying to set up a situation of benchmarking what happens tomorrow against the three major events that happened in October, November and December.
What's unreasonable about that?
Because the nature of the protest tomorrow is quite different. It's very, very widespread, very locally based and taking many, many different forms with major protests and marches in some areas. In other areas, very widely dispersed actions, for example, Limerick, totally citywide and countywide dispersal into shopping areas, into public areas, etc. And it was never designed or organized or centrally brought together in any way and was not meant to be in the same as the three key events that took place last year.
So who decided that tomorrow would be a day of protest if it hasn't been centrally organised? Who decided tomorrow was the day?
Well, this is the very strength of the anti-water charges campaign is the fact that it is locally based and it is a movement from below. And it is taking that form in as a movement of ordinary people. And for example, last Saturday there were several protests in different areas, and there are rallies ongoing, night times, etc., next weekend again. So it's not and hasn't been set up as, for example, October the 10th or October the 11th or December the 10th. There will be, as the payment comes into focus in April and May, be the organization of more centralized events. For example, Right to Water is, I believe, now going to call for a major protest in April the 25th. And in fact, the focus is shifting very much to April and May when the bills begin to arrive. And many groups are now, in fact, preparing and organizing already for what will decide this issue, really, which is a mass boycott of the bills as they arrive. And it is a mass organized non-payment, a refusal to pay by the decent taxpaying backbone of this country who have paid for everything.
How would you describe the million households?
Those is what will decide the fate of the water charges.
Okay. How would you describe the million households who've signed up so?
The registration is inconsequential, quite frankly. In the million that Irish Water is claiming is over 20% who they, as they put it in their language, are not their customers because they sent out 2.1 million packs. But of those who have returned in some form, and many people have returned forms saying they have want nothing to do with this, the fact is many people have told me that they have registered just for one reason or another, but they intend fully to join the boycott. So a major campaign of boycott is what will completely undermine...
Well, it depends on your definition of major. When you have a million households, now you're saying that Irish Water are claiming to have sent... Are you disputing that figure?
Whether a million people have responded, perhaps, yes. I'm saying that it's not significant in the context of what the reaction will be in April and May when the bills arrive. First of all, I said, which Irish Water says, that more than 20% of that in any case are from households which, as Irish Water put it, are not their customers. It's inconsequential, frankly. It's in April and May when the bills arrive and when people understand that the strongest weapon that they have is to join together in solidarity and to refuse to pay this odious charge, which is totally rejected by a huge majority of our people, understanding that the trickery of the government in bringing down the charges for a short period will result in charges for water rocketing to horrific levels if the pressure is off and the tendency to privatization in no sense being removed. Mm. Therefore, this story will intensify massively in April and May and up to and at, if they're not already abolished, the next general election. With such merciless pressure, political pressure on the government and the government parties, in my view, that the water charges cannot survive the next general election campaign, even if they are, if they're not abolished before that, that is.
Okay, if I can ask you just briefly, Joe Higgins, about some of the protests which have been taking place. They've been very well publicised. The president been targeted, and the tarnished, in fact, in Raheny been targeted this week. Would you appeal to people, or would you agree that it is time for some people to moderate their tone and their behaviour who are involved in these protests?
Look, hundreds of thousands of people, ordinary people around the country, have participated in
Which is why I said some people, a specific small group of people who are clearly identifiable.
From what I have seen, have engaged in offensive behaviour, in disgracefully insulting personalised language. We condemn that, and the future of the campaign depends on well-organised, peaceful, disciplined protests and boycott, as I have indicated. Mm. My colleague, Paul Murphy, has been disgracefully and maliciously represented in sections of the media over the event around the presidency for which he had no hand.
Well, he had a chance to clarify that very clearly on the News at One this week, and he was quite clear in criticising and condemning the language
used. Sections of the media insist on misrepresenting. We defend the right of people everywhere to conduct peaceful, well-disciplined protest lobbies, etc. We strongly oppose behaviour that is offensive, but that is willfully and maliciously distorted by some as saying that the right that ordinary people have to conduct peaceful, well-disciplined protest, that defending that is then synonymous with defending the behaviour of a very few that most people would reject.
All right. Joe Higgins, Socialist TD, thank you for speaking to us.
The family of Robert Hamill, a Catholic man who was beaten to death by loyalists in Armagh almost 20 years ago, say they're dismayed after information relating to the case went missing in the post. Officials from the UK's Ministry of Justice realised two discs containing potentially sensitive documents about the Robert Hamill inquiry and two others, that of Mark Duggan and Azel Rodney, were lost in early January. All three cases were subject to judge-led inquiries. Fiona Mitchell is our London correspondent. Good morning, Fiona.
Good morning, Gavin.
We'll talk about the lost and the post bit in a minute, but remind us, what happened to Robert Hamill and where the inquiry to his death is at now?
Well, as you say, these discs that have gone missing contain information from what could easily be described as three of the most sensitive inquiries by the UK police. Robert Hamill was very, very badly beaten by loyalists in 1997 in Portadown. Now, there have always been accusations of police collusion into his death. His family have always wanted to find out exactly what happened. There have been accusations that police stood by and watched while the beating took place. He died some weeks after that beating in hospital. And so it has always been a very controversial case, as have the other two. You may remember that the case of Mark Duggan, he was shot dead by police in 2011, and his death precipitated the very severe riots of that year, both in London and various other parts of the UK. And also the case of Azelle Rodney has been hugely controversial over here. He was shot dead by Metropolitan Police in 2005. Now, all of those cases are involved in these files that have gone missing. All of them, as you say, subject to judge-led inquiries, because in each inquiry there were witnesses, including police officers, who were given anonymity because of possible threats to their safety. So obviously that information now, we do not know whether that information is in the public domain or has gone lost in the postal system.
So a disc with information were relation to his and the other two cases missing, what happened?
Well, it appears that these files, or these discs containing these files, were posted. Now, what we do know at this point is that it was discovered on about the 8th of January that these files had gone missing. They had obviously not reached their destination. A major inquiry and investigation started to try and track them down, but has been unsuccessful. As a result, in the last 24 hours, the families of the three men involved in these inquiries were informed of the fact that the files have gone missing. Now, the Ministry for Justice here is not saying anything more other than the files have gone missing. They're not saying what exactly were on the discs. And obviously they are taking it incredibly seriously. They say that they have taken immediate steps, including intensive searches to try and locate the discs, and that those searches continue with police assistance. They don't know what has happened to them. They say they don't believe that there was any malicious intent, but obviously now severe questions as to why they were posted in the first place.
Yeah, exactly. If they were that important, why were they sent to the post? The Ministry of Defence may not have answered this question, of course.
They haven't answered it yet, Gavin, because what they're doing is they're saying that their investigations are continuing. They say that one person has been suspended as this inquiry takes place. But there have been a huge amount of controversial circumstances in recent years where sensitive information has gone missing, whether it's been left on a train or various other situations. So everybody had felt that these kind of security elements had been tightened up. The other question, of course, would be about these discs, have they been encrypted? And that will also be a key question to be answered in the coming days.
Robert Hamill's inquiry finished some years ago, almost 4 years ago now. It still hasn't reported publicly. What difference, if any, will losing this disc make to his inquiry?
Well, that really is unclear as of yet, Gavin. I mean, as you can imagine, in recent days, family have been finding out about this, and they are incredibly upset, understandably, about what has happened. The Hamill family said that they had been contacted, or their solicitor had been contacted, to say that the material had gone missing in the post. They say they're very upset, very dismayed by that, and that they're going to be seeking urgent answers to a number of questions which arise, because they really have had very few details so far. They want to know whether or not the information on the disc was encrypted. As I say, that will be a key question. And if not, why not? And also they want to know when the disc was posted and how long it took before the loss was discovered.
Fiona Mitchell in London.
Forgot to mention, after speaking to Joe Higgins, something from yesterday's programme. You might remember we covered the story of costs which were being incurred by the Department of Social Protection in administering the €100 grant to Irish water consumers. We said in the programme yesterday that we'd asked for an interview with the Taoiseach and Minister for Social Protection, Joan Burton, but she wasn't available. We had, in fact, only requested an interview with the Minister yesterday morning, and it wasn't possible for Joan Burton to reschedule her diary at such short notice. Now, no doubt you've seen people using e-cigarettes. Vaping is for many an alternative to smoking. Whether it's less damaging to your health, we don't yet know. So with a lack of clarity on what's in these products or if they can be damaging to health, two senators are launching a bill today which will deal with the regulation of e-cigarettes. One of them, Senator Eivear Power, is with us now. Good morning to you. John Crowe is the other senator. What exactly are you proposing?
We're launching a bill today which would essentially mean that e-cigarettes would be regulated in exactly the same way as tobacco, as normal cigarettes. So we're not banning them or anything like that. It's just ensuring the same regulations are there. As things stand in Ireland, there are no regulations at all on e-cigarettes. They can be sold to children. There's no age restrictions. I have health warnings, and yet we know that while e-cigarettes, they're not as harmful as tobacco, they don't contain all the same toxins as tobacco, they are still damaging to your health. It still has high levels of nicotine. They have other toxins in them that are damaging.
Do we really know what's in them?
Well, the WHO and others have, like, the problem is there are now 500 brands of e-cigarettes. So in terms of each individual product, the answer is no, we don't. And we should take pause from that because that's worrying. But on the whole, we do know that they all contain nicotine. And that nicotine is bad for your cardiovascular system. Long-term use is very damaging to your health. We also know from these cigarettes that have been tested that they don't just release water vapour into the air, that there are toxins that are released into the vapour into the air as well, which are damaging to bystanders, including children. So it's for that reason we think we should be cautious. The fact that as well, children have been poisoned in Ireland, the UK. One child died in the States from drinking liquid nicotine because they come in bottles that don't have
concentrated fluid,
and they don't have safety caps. So just practical things like that. So our bill would basically subject e-cigarettes to just the same regulations as cigarettes, that they couldn't be sold to those under 18, couldn't be consumed in areas where the workplace smoking ban applies, restrictions on advertising, sponsorship. That's important as well because it seems that e-cigarettes are being very cleverly marketed in the way that cigarettes used to be. Advertised to children and teenagers. They're now, many of these cigarettes are owned by cigarette companies, your traditional cigarette companies.
Yes, isn't that a reality that you have major tobacco companies buying these e-cigarette companies out and developing products further?
Yeah, and I mean, some people find that they find e-cigarettes useful as a quid aid, and that's good. And anything that gets people off tobacco, and as I've said, they're e-cigarettes seem to be less harmful than tobacco. But there's also disputed, the WHO, the World Health Organization, the HSC and others have disputed whether really e-cigarettes will lead to less smoking or not. A lot of people are using both, so they've actually increased their consumption. They're smoking tobacco in places where they're allowed to smoke tobacco, and they're vaping in the workplace, they're vaping in other areas where they can, so they've actually increased their intake. Others are finding that they're just migrating from one to the other, so they're smoking as many e-cigarettes as cigarettes. And the other big worry from the WHO's point of view is that teenagers are taking up vaping who would never smoke. And as a result, you could end up actually with a larger number of people smoking overall, which is a real concern.
There's an EU directive on this which has to be transposed into Irish law anyway within something like a year and a half or 2 years. So is what you're proposing much different, or does it broadly...
The EU directive mainly covers sales and marketing, and I suppose it's the lowest common denominator across the UK, not all or across Europe. Not all other European countries, say, have a workplace smoking ban in the way that we do. Whereas this rolls out the workplace smoking ban as well. That's consistent with Ireland. It's consistent with the approach that's been taken in the US in particular. Places like New York, Chicago have taken the same approach, just regulate them like cigarettes. Come from a position of caution because there's so much we don't know about how harmful they are, and just protect people from the health effects and make users aware. At the end of the day, it's people's own choice if they want to smoke, and we're not trying to interfere with that. But they need to be aware of the health risks. And I think there's been a lot of cynical marketing by the cigarette companies and elsewhere to try and advertise these cigarettes as a harmless way of getting a nicotine hit, and that's just not the case.
Okay, it might be a starting point if we knew what was in them. Senator Eivear Power, thank you for coming into us.
Des Cahill here at the Sports News. Morning, Des.
Morning, Gavin. It's interesting to see Graeme McDowell challenging at the top of the leaderboard in the Dubai Desert Classic. He's picked up 6 shots so far today in his opening 13 holes. He's on 11 under par. He's flying. He's 1 shot behind the leader, Danny Willett. The only other Irish player on the course at the moment, Peter Lawrie, he's levelled par after 14 holes. That's one shot outside the projected cut. The other Irish players have yet to begin their round. Rory McIlroy, well placed in 6 under. Damien McGrain is 1 under. Michael Hoey levelled par and Darren Clark is 1 over. Now, Tiger Woods had a bit of a nightmare start last night in the Phoenix Open. I was watching it. He was 4 over par after 4 holes.
Oh.
A desperate start from the. He was 5 over after 12, but he recovered well, finished on 2 over. But it still left him 9 shots behind the leader, the American Ryan Palmer.
Now, a toothless display, even, yeah.
That was coined last night on Twitter. Patrick Harrington had an extraordinary shot, so he was in the rough on the 17th, and he holed out from 161 yards in the rough for an eagle two. So that brought him back to level par after 17 holes, and darkness stopped play. So he'll finish today on level par. Now in tennis, the defending champion Stan Wawrinka and the world number one Novak Djokovic will go head to head for a place in the Australian Open final later this morning. The pair meet at the tournament for a third year in succession. Both meetings previously ended in epic 5 sets games. Each of these winners then went on to lift the championship trophy. Now, Britain's Andy Murray, of course, is awaiting the winner in the final on Sunday. Djokovic has been talking about the progress made in the last year by his opponent.
We all knew that he has great quality tennis, but you know, mentally he was he didn't believe enough that he can win Grand Slams, and I think that changed in the last 2 years. That's why he's a Grand Slam champion, Davis Cup champion, and he's playing very confident. He's one of the guys to beat in this tournament, so I look forward to the challenge.
Now, the big action in Ireland today is the rugby clash of the Irish Wolfhounds and the England Saxons in Cork this evening. The match, which is live on RTE2, features Sean O'Brien starting in an Ireland shirt for the first time in 14 months after shoulder surgery. Keith Earls also back after a long injury. The only uncapped player in the starting 15 is Jack Conan, who lines out at number 8. Now, the GAA season kicks off in full this weekend. Some interesting team selections. With the details, here's Brian Carthy.
Returning Aussie Rules player Tommy Walsh has been listed among the substitutes on the Kerry team to face Mayo in Division 1 of the Allianz Football League at Fitzgerald Stadium, Killarney on Sunday. The team is captained by All-Star David Morden, who was named at midfield alongside Brian Sheehan. Just 6 of the team that lined out against Donegal in last September's All-Ireland final feature in the starting 15 for Sunday. Those 6 are defenders Fionn Fitzgerald and Paul Murphy, midfielder David Morden, and forwards Stephen O'Brien, Johnny Buckley and Paul Ganey. Keith Higgins will captain a Mayo team that has Donal Vaughan at midfield alongside Seamus O'Shea. Stephen Cohn and Patrick Durkin are drafted into the defence, while Adam Gallagher, Evan Regan and Mark Ronaldson feature in the forward division. Meanwhile, Conor McAtamney is selected at midfield alongside team captain Mark Lynch on the Derry team to play Donegal in Ballybuffet tomorrow night. Owen Bradley is named among the substitutes. Pádraig McNulty will make his league debut for Tyrone against Monaghan, that at Healy Park in Omagh tomorrow night. McNulty will line out at midfield along with Colm Kavanagh. And Owen Cadigan has been selected at centre-half-back on the Cork team to face Dublin at Parky Rean on Sunday. Donnie O'Connor will line out at centre-half-forward, Donalogue Hodnett at full-forward.
Thanks, Brian. In the Fitzgibbon Cup games, there were wins for Cork IT, UCD, UL, UCC, Waterford and Limerick IT. In the one-day cricket international this morning, England are preparing to bat. India all out for 200 from 48.1 overs. In racing, Ruby Walsh rode his 50th winner of the season. In snowy conditions at Thurles, he guided the Willie Mullins trained totally dominant to victory in the 2 mile maiden hurdle. This evening's action is Dundalk, 5:35, the opening race.
Des, thank you.
To business now, here's Connor.
Fran, Google shares fell in after hours trading when quarterly numbers showed a slowdown in the rate of revenue growth and negative currency effects as a weaker euro hit profits from Europe when translated back into dollars. Google's fourth quarter net revenue of $14.5 billion was $300 million lower than analysts had been expecting. Over €30 billion worth of loans were sold by Irish banks and the National Asset Management Agency last year, and a new report by accountants PwC predicts at least a further €6 billion will be sold this year. Much of that was property-related debt, and the Irish market accounted for almost a third of the total loan sales across Europe last year. David Tynan is corporate finance partner with PwC. David, just explain the background here, first of all. Why such a large quantum of Irish loans being sold in such a short period of time?
Thank you, Conor. I think there's a build-up over the last 5 or 6 years of the Irish banking market, and it's taken this time to get the systems in place to allow a volume of this to transact. I think it's quite a good thing from Ireland as an overall point of view, as we're ahead of the game in terms of the other European countries. I see next year being another strong year, probably between 12 and 15 billion of loans being transacted, but that should take most of the bad loans out of the system and allow us to return to a more normal banking market.
So how far through the deleveraging or restructuring programme for the Irish banks are we then at this point? It sounds like it is winding down.
I think we're well over halfway through it. We're probably 60-70% through it, and I'd hope by the end of 2015 we'd have the bulk of the deleveraging out of the way.
The point has been made, though, that while Ireland has been out of the gates relatively quickly, now a lot of other European banks and a lot of banks in other countries are going to be disposing of loans in greater quantity. So there'll be more competition out there, I guess.
I think there will be, but I think that the buyers have established themselves in the Irish market over the last 5 to 6 years, have put in place platforms, have got very comfortable with the Irish regulatory regime and legal regime. So I think they are willing to pay that bit extra for Irish loans over and above what might be seen to be more competitive markets in Southern Europe.
For those buyers picking over the carrion, as it were, what sort of value have they been getting? 30 billion worth of loans sold, what sort of face value would that debt have been at?
The stats aren't totally accurate, but I suspect it's somewhere in the region of 50% discount on the overall face value.
And your report says 2 trillion still in unwanted debt on bank balance sheets. That still seems a long way to go to get back to normality.
A lot, and the asset quality review that was taking place last year has identified a lot of assets in Europe that need to wind out. Thankfully, that Ireland isn't one of those countries that needs to accelerate that process, but we're ahead of the game.
That asset quality review, I suppose, would have been more popularly known as the stress test. That's what we're talking
about here.
Well, yeah. We hope there will be less stressful times ahead. David Tynan, corporate finance partner with PwC, thanks for coming into us this morning. The euro worth $1, $13.3 this morning at 75.2 sterling.
Conor, thank you. A photo in the newspapers this morning of the Russian ambassador here visiting Oris and Ukhtaron. But in Britain, Russia's man has been summoned to account for why 2 Russian bomber planes flew close to UK airspace, disrupting civil aviation on Wednesday. The planes went past our west coast too. The Minister for Defence here says he's aware of the incident. Fintan Ryan is a former Aer Lingus pilot and a former engineer with Inmarsat. He's in our studio. Fintan, thanks for coming in to us. What do you make of all this?
Well, I suppose this is going on all the time, and it only now and then it comes to the notice of the public. But the Russians are send these aircraft out, and to get near the UK, you have to come at the UK, not from over Europe, but you'll have to come at it from the west, because otherwise the radar systems that are in the continental Europe will pick up, that is the primary radar systems, will pick up those aircraft. So they came down from the north and they skirted the Irish coast. I don't know how close they came to the Irish coast, but they could have been as long as they stayed about 70 miles away from Shannon or Cork, they wouldn't be detected because they had their transponder switched off. And air traffic control in these days depends totally on aircraft cooperating, and these aircraft were not cooperating.
Now, it's a bit dangerous. I gather the RAF say they escorted these 2 Russian bombers, but they didn't tell civil aviation authorities either. So the potential for an accident was quite high, wasn't it?
Well, the military aircraft, the RAF, they would have had their transponders on, so the air traffic control would have been able to see them.
Okay.
But the Russians had taken off their transponders. Now, they were operating in what's called the North Atlantic Track System, which is a highly disciplined, regulated traffic area where there's a tidal flow of aircraft. In the morning, the aircraft are all flying towards the west, and in the evening, and the early morning, they're flying towards the east. All these aircraft are 1,000 feet above and below. They're wingtip to wingtip, 60 nautical miles apart. And there are 10 minutes between them in terms of longitudinal separation. And they all have their transponders on. And these transponders as well, they talk to one another. And aircraft coming too close to one another, these transponder systems actually analyse the manoeuvres that are necessary for an aircraft to actually avoid colliding with other aircraft. But the Russians just barged in. They're down in this airspace. I would say the safety margins were seriously eroded by this action by the Russians.
I know I'm asking you to speculate. Why do you think they do this?
Well, there are two reasons. One is, if you like, a political reason, publicity. We're there. We're showing you what we can do. But the other reason is they probed the defence systems of the, let's say, the NATO countries, and you have a situation where they actually come in, and all the radars and all the rest on the ground, they all illuminate the aircraft, they shine beams on it, and the aircraft, the Russian aircraft, then analyses these beams and says, this is what we're going to have to put up with if we're doing this for real eventually. So it's really they're trying to make their countermeasures better by actually probing these defences. Of course, we have no real primary radar. The only primary radars we have is about 70 nautical miles from Cork, Dublin and Shannon.
And if they'd waited till today to do it, according to reports we're hearing from across the country, they would have been able to do so in snow-free skies. Fintan Ryan, thanks very much for coming into us this morning.
Hazardous alcohol consumption is high among students, according to research being published today by University College Cork. It's been published, incidentally, in the British Medical Journal. In fact, more than 66% of undergrads who responded to questions had hazardous alcohol consumption levels. The research was conducted at UCC. One of the researchers, Martin Davern, is in our Cork studio this morning. Good morning, Martin.
Good morning.
Two-thirds of students have a problem with alcohol. What else have you found?
So I think the major finding here was a narrowing of the gender gap. So 10 years ago, the most recent research on alcohol consumption among university students outlined that 61% of males and 44% of females were binge drinking weekly. The current research highlights that women are now drinking as much as their male counterparts. So 65% of men were consuming at a hazardous level and 67% of women.
What's a hazardous level?
So a hazardous level can be defined as a pattern of alcohol consumption that increases the risk of harmful consequences to either the user or others around them. We use the Alcohol Use Disorders Identification Test for consumption to define this. So that was developed by the World Health Organization, and it looks at frequency of consumption, the number of units the person consumes, and the number of binge drinking occasions that occur.
So how much, give us an example in units, I suppose. What's a problem?
Units... Previously, we've always looked at binge drinking as a level of hazardous alcohol consumption, so over 60 units of alcohol consumed. The World Health Organization have moved this forward, so now we can look at frequency of consumption and how often people are drinking. So on the higher end of the scale, we found that 17% of men and 5% of women had an Odyssey score of 10 or higher. And that meant that they were consuming more than 6 units of alcohol at least 4 times per week. And in some cases, that might be daily.
Now, this is where you go and you pose questions to a group of students. How many and how did you structure this study?
So we randomly selected students at a degree program level here at University College Cork. So following random sampling, we approached lecturers and asked them for 15 minutes of class time so we could go in, outline the aims and objectives of the research, and distribute and collect the questionnaire. The questionnaire included questions that had been previously validated from other research. So the Odyssey, which I've already outlined, and it looked at adverse consequences of alcohol, so things such as getting into a physical fight, missing days from work or studies due to their alcohol consumption patterns. Once we collected all of this, we had 2,275 students complete the questionnaire. This represented a 51% response rate from those who were actually registered to the modules that we visited, and an 81% response rate based on those that were actually in class at the time. Mm.
You referred at the outset there to a narrowing of the gender gap. So what that translates as is women are probably drinking as much or close to as much as men. Is that a change in what we have perceived in the past, or a change in what previous studies have actually proven?
So previous studies have shown that there was always quite a stark difference in the amount consumed by men and women. This is particularly noteworthy the concern given women's increased innate susceptibility to the harmful effects of alcohol. But this changing cultural norm, we're not sure if it's arisen as a direct consequence of alcohol marketing or whether it's a direct consequence of the cultural norm that's now changing out there.
All right. Martin Davern, thank you for joining us from UCC this morning. Martin Davern there, one of the authors of that research, which is being published in the British Medical Journal today.
According to those of you who've been in touch, and thank you for that, no snow falling where you are either. What does the weather hold in store for the weekend? Owen Sherlock is at Met Air. Morning, Owen.
Thank you, and a very good morning. Well, it is cool and breezy today, and there is some frost and ice at first this morning. But the day itself is going to be generally dry, with a mix of bright spells and showers, though showers mostly of rain at lower levels, but some may turn wintry on higher ground. Highs of 4 to 7 degrees today, and fresh and gusty northwest winds. And it's going to be cold and windy tonight, with further wintry showers in parts of the country, but many areas will stay dry with clear spells, lows tonight of 0 to 3 degrees, with frost as well as ice on any untreated surfaces. Tomorrow Saturday is going to be a cold and a windy day too, with bright spells and further scattered wintry showers. Highs of only 4 to 6 degrees tomorrow in fresh and gusty northerly winds. And Saturday night is going to be bitterly cold as temperatures fall between 0 and minus 4 degrees. There will be further wintry showers overnight, mainly in parts of the west and the north, and frost and ice will also be a threat in moderate northerly winds. And now the outlook for the next few days. This cold weather will stay in place later in the weekend as well into next weekend. Now for some details. It's going to be a bright, frosty start to Sunday, and it's going to remain dry in many areas. But once again, coastal counties of the west and the north will be at risk of further wintry showers. Cold, with afternoon highs of only 3 to 6 degrees. And it's going to become very cold once again after dark on Sunday, with temperatures falling to between 0 and minus 4 or even minus 5 degrees. Once again, those coastal counties of the west and the north are most at risk of wintry showers. Elsewhere, it will be drier, with long clear spells, and frost and ice will form once again. There is some uncertainty regarding Monday. At the moment, it looks like coastal parts of the north, west and south will experience some rain during the day. It's going to be another cold day, though, with highs of only 3 to 5 degrees and slack winds. Later in the evening, it looks like a weather front will finally move into western parts. This rain is likely to turn to sleet and snow overnight on Monday, as it spread eastwards overnight. And that rain, sleet and snow will gradually clear away on Tuesday, and it looks like the rest of next week will remain cold both at day and at night, but with a good deal of dry weather. So a quick recap for today. Cold and breezy with scattered showers, some will be wintry, and we can expect highs of 4 to 7 degrees. And that's the forecast. A very good morning.